Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I presume the Russ George story was over, but he rose again. This time, George used a relationship he built with the Aboriginal people of Haida Gwaii in the early 2000s. Again, it was a plot to sell carbon credits, this time by planting trees. That fell through. But Russ George apparently persuaded tribal leaders they could sequester carbon and make millions of dollars by seeding ocean plankton with algae again. This theory, unproven by at least a half dozen experiments done by real scientists aboard multi-governmental research ships, the theory was the algae bloom would sink to the bottom with its carbon. Not proven. Somehow the leadership of a tiny place in British Columbia called the Village of Old Masset cashed in money to raise $2.5 million for a new try in the Pacific. If the villagers were not sold on carbon credits, the story changed. Now they would be saving the dwindling salmon, returning the fishing industry to the many unemployed native people. In my Radio EcoShock show for October 12, 2012, I found a scientist who disputed the whole basis of the Russ George theory of plankton starving for iron dust or saving salmon. Russ George is not a scientist or even a university graduate, despite being called the chief scientist on last summer's ocean dumping experiment. Real Canadian scientists say there is no way to prove the latest claims. The Canadian government says Environment Canada advised the Haida Salmon Restoration Group not to try it. Now the government has raided the offices. Russ George complains about it in his blog. Quote, "Just days before Easter, our small village research office in Vancouver was swarmed by 11 officers dressed in all black combat gear, armed and imposing beyond belief. In the largest assault raid in Environment Canada's history, the raid team rushed into the office of 7 people, counting the 2 grandfathers and 2 women present." End quote from Russ George at russgeorge.net. What did he expect? After breaking the moratorium on such experiments, agreed by the London Dumping Convention, specifically after his previous attempts to capitalize on changing our oceans with the Plankto ship Weatherbird 2. Sadly, while George and the Haida may be charged with breaking environmental laws, I don't know, I don't expect any justice for the highly unemployed people of the village of Old Masset. Their $2.5 million has been taken by a serial dreamer and promoter named Russ George with the help of tribal leaders, including Mr. Disney. Watch out if you see Russ George coming again. It seems nothing but prison could stop Russ George in his mission to save the world while making money. He'll be back. But Russ George is a small-time operator compared to the multi-billion-dollar scams perpetrated on the ratepayers of Europe. They paid for carbon offsets under the World Bank Clean Development Mechanism to stop climate-damaging chemical plants in Asia that were never built, or built only to produce, or not produce, a certain powerful greenhouse gas. Nobody stopped that ripoff for years. They knew it was going on, and no one was ever charged. I'm sorry, but the whole plan for carbon offsets and carbon markets to make money just falls prey to human greed and self-delusion. We are carbon addicts who will say anything and believe it. The only true solution is to cut the drug off at its source, close down the tar sands, divert military spending and oil subsidies into clean energy, forget about coal, we must leave it in the ground. We must change our own lives going carbon free. Anything else is human fraud on a massive scale, setting us up for mass extinction. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock. Find a link to the full CBC documentary by the Fifth Estate called The Iron Man at cbc.ca or in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. It is unthinkable that Ethiopia could double its population to 185 million people by 2050. But what if that does happen? Can anyone prevent it? We continue our series on population growth versus the fragile environment. Our guest is a political scientist who specializes in population. Dr. Martha Campbell lectures in the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. She founded and runs the nonprofit group Venture Strategies for Health and Development. Martha Campbell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate you joining this discussion. I found your essay in the new book, Life on the Brink, Environmentalists confront population. And reading your essay, Why the Silence on Population, and I think that's a key question, my jaw dropped by the second paragraph. You list some of the poorest nations. For example, Pakistan, as you say, it's just 20% larger than Texas. It's a desert-like country with just one major river for water. They had 41 million people when I was born, and now 185 million people. And unbelievably, by 2050, Pakistan is projected to have more people than the United States does now. To start with, Martha, who makes up these numbers and what are they based on?
Well, in fact, the numbers are put together by the Population Division of the United Nations. There are about 60 people, demographers, working on these elements of information, and they come from a lot of different sources. They come from sources from the countries themselves and just many different areas of expertise. They're pretty dependable. Sometimes they have to shift what they find, but on the whole, they're quite dependable.
Tell us about some of the other projected growth numbers that concern you and should worry us all.
Niger, as a matter of fact, in the north, and in fact the whole area of the Sahel, the country that is just from the west to the east of Africa and south of the Sahara Desert, the fertility is very, very high. But Niger has the highest birth rate in the world of 7.6 children on average. There is nothing that you can do take care of this situation unless you let women have the ability to manage whether and when to have a child. But this is in a society. What you have there is early marriage, and what you have there is also polygamy. And young girls are often married to much older men, and they don't have any other choices. This is the kind of thing that you need to be able to manage. Those populations are going to go from 5 million just a few years ago up to, something like 300 million people by 2050. And these are really astonishing numbers, but it's a great concern.
Well, as I said to the American environmental activist Dave Foreman, many of us can't hear those numbers as a reality. We have an automatic turn-off kind of denial machine that says it just won't happen. Instead of a Deus ex machina where some good force intervenes, we presume a kind of salvation by a devil like plague or starvation. So what about you, Martha? Do you think some of this population growth that's been predicted might actually happen?
Yes. The growth is going to happen very, very rapidly. There is no way around that. Many people will die, but many, many more people will have large numbers of children and will grow a lot faster than the kinds of deaths that have been projected.
Okay. Well, now you give lectures to students about population problems. How do they take it? Is it real to them?
The students take it very well, and in fact, they're fascinated, and they come to our classes religiously, and they are learning more and more. And then a lot of them want to come and work with us, as a matter of fact, at Berkeley, to figure out what it is that we can do.
Well, news articles, as you know, say the fertility rates are dropping in many countries. The United Nations has told us over and over again the population will level off somewhere around 9 billion people. Aren't we given the impression this problem is solving itself?
Yes, and in fact, economists have often said that the problem is going to solve itself, and they're really, really wrong. For a long time, in fact, for over a decade, the UN was saying that we're going to level off at 9 billion people. And finally, they changed it, and now they've said that it's likely to be more like 10.1 billion people at least by the year 2100. What they were doing was building in assumptions that there would be extra efforts. I've spent a lot of time in the UN. And one of the times that I talked with the chief demographer having to do with fertility, I said, why are you still telling the press, telling everybody that this is going to level off at 9 billion people? Because if you do that, nobody's going to put any extra effort into it. And the answer was, we've built the extra effort into our assumptions. And I just couldn't believe it. And now I think they're doing it again. Even though I have friends in the UN, I do think that they're assuming that the public is going to actually take this on and run with it and make it happen rather than just watch happening.
Well, that's very interesting because that's exactly what the climate scientists were doing at the UN when they were saying, well, we've made these projections, but it's based on people giving up oil and people taking a lot of social action, and that hasn't happened. So we have a parallel there. Now, we should talk about the reasons for social silence on population in Western countries, in the media, and in green movements. You called it a perfect storm. Can you explain that? Just give us the overall picture of some of those forces.
Yes, the silence around population has been interesting because there are so many factors behind it, and some of them more important than others. And one of them is the visibility of a decline in birth rates around much of the world. And by the way, the poorest 40 countries or so are growing very fast. So we do see the decline on the whole. But when you have many more people increasing, you still have a huge problem. The second one is that conservative political and religious forces really prefer not to talk about it. So that's part of the silence right there. This is a matter of patriarchy, as a matter of fact. The tragedy of AIDS has dominated national health concerns. And so a lot of attention has gone to AIDS. The AIDS people have actually done very, very good publicity in getting people to understand the importance of this. This has drawn attention away. A lot of people think, oh, AIDS is going to take care of it. And we think, that's terrible. We don't want this to happen because of AIDS. And besides, the AIDS is just a drop in the bucket compared to the rapid population growth in the whole world. There's a fourth one, and that is there is well-justified attention to consumption on the environment. And so a lot of people say, well, consumption is a lot more of a problem than population growth. But it is, in fact, if you can't do anything about the population factor, everything you try to do about the environment is going to be wiped away. And fifth, women's advocacy groups in 1994 made it politically incorrect to talk about population or family planning. This, I think, is the biggest silence of all. So a vast number of people were indoctrinated around 1992, actually to 94, to believe that family planning has been mainly coercive, which is not correct, and population is all about coercion. A lot of people still believe this, and for this reason, the environmentalists are silent on this too. And the last one, finally, is all of this is based on a long-held theory called the demographic transition theory, which we know now is not justified. There are many demographers and most economists believe that the only way you can slow population growth is by coercive birth control, which is very, very sad because it's not correct, but it means everybody feels you can't talk about it anymore. So it's been silent for almost 20 years. We've picked up on this in about the last 2 years. People are beginning to talk about it more. And some of the media are too, and we're very glad to see that. But we have to move faster.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Martha Campbell, a lecturer and director for International Population Dialogue at the School of Public Health, University of California, Berkeley. Martha, we've just seen the election of yet another very conservative pope in the Catholic Church. The regime of fighting any kind of contraception or family planning lives on at the Vatican and in so many American evangelical churches. How do you rate the effect of religion in the continuing growth of the human species?
I think religion, unfortunately, and these religions, conservative ones, are doing huge, huge damage. How many women have died because they have many more children than they wanted to have and they're unable to get birth control if they want it, and most women do want it. It really is about patriarchy. It's about keeping control of women. And I think that a lot of people have ignored it. In the North, they have. 98% of Catholics in the United States have used contraception one way or another. Most of Europe has simply sloughed off the whole subject, but many parts of the world are covered with beliefs in the Catholic Church, for example. In the other parts of the world, a lot of people take this seriously and feel that they shouldn't use contraception. In the meantime, however, as the World Health Organization has pointed out, 6 million women every year in Africa have unsafe abortions. 26,000 of them die, and multiples of those 26,000 are injured for the rest of their lives. So women feel they can't use contraception, but in desperation they find terrible, terrible means for stopping a pregnancy. And the huge, huge damage that this causes is just outrageous.
This is a super serious issue, but I have to ask you about your new paper, and it's titled, Do Economists Have Frequent Sex? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, a number of our friends in several universities and all are laughing about this. Well, we have recognized that we do know that all around the world, human beings across societies worldwide, unlike most other mammals, have sex hundreds or even thousands of times more frequently than is necessary to conceive a number of pregnancies that they want. So unless women have the knowledge and the means to separate sex from childbearing, their default position is really a large family. They don't have any choices. And in many countries, women still live in the depths of poverty. Very often they're treated as property, and they have little access to contraception. There are many barriers to that. And a woman who does not have enough power to tell her husband no sex tonight, you know, or unless he treat her roughly or take on another wife or another girlfriend, it leaves her and her children with less food. Economists believe, on the whole, that if you have more wealth and more education, then somehow couples will find a way to have smaller family. They'll find a way to manage their childbearing. But they don't seem to recognize that couples have frequent sex all around the world. Several years ago, we came to realize that most economists might not be aware that couples everywhere have sex frequently. So in jest, we then began to propose to our graduate students that the only explanation that we could think of where economists seem not to be aware of this common pattern is that maybe economists don't have frequent sex. So this is all done in jest in a very serious paper. It's only that part of it and the title of it that is funny, because it really does describe the situation that we're in, where the economists don't understand. It has got some attention. We haven't yet sent it into the World Bank, but we're going to do that. I think they'll be laughing, too.
It's pretty tiresome, though, to hear so many men who are well-educated who just don't get it when it comes to the choices that face most of the women of the world, would you say?
Yes, I think that's right. I think patriarchy is a very normal thing. It is, has ended in a number of countries, starting with Scandinavia, of course, in the past. But also, it is very natural, I think, for men to want to keep control of women. And this is an evolutionary thing. They don't recognize it themselves, necessarily. But it is since time immemorial, men have always wanted to control women. And you can think about the reason for this is they really would like to know whose babies that their women are carrying. And yet they will also sort of hold on to this kind of situation or hold on to this behavior for a long time, and it covers a lot of things other than reproduction.
Well, Martha, why do you think environmentalists are ducking the population issue?
The reason for the environmentalists to be silent on this issue and for whole environmental organizations to be silent on this issue is that they are afraid of the subject. They have been taught, they've been indoctrinated too, as have women's groups by certain groups of women who organized this in 1994, that if in fact you talk about population, if you try to reduce fertility, then that's telling people what to do. Whereas we know that family planning should be about letting women have options, not about telling people what to do at all. I was in the United Nations at the time, just before the Cairo conference in 1994, when the women's groups who decided to do this made a statement saying that we must separate in this upcoming meeting as it was going to take place in Cairo, that we must not keep together environment and population in the same conference at all. We need to keep them separate. That was a very, very strange thing to do. But at the same time, that information got out that we must not talk about population anymore. We must not talk about family planning. Instead, we have to talk about reproductive health. And this has put a great deal of fear into the organizations around the environment.
Well, it seems pretty obvious to me that women's rights and the population problem are tied tightly together. If the human herd is already overwhelming nature, can we escape the conclusion that environmentalists are going to have to become champions of women's rights around the world as well?
You are absolutely right. Absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I told you before, I used to work in the Packard Foundation, the David and Lucille Packard Foundation in Los Altos, California, and had the privilege of heading the population program, which was also including reproductive rights. We've been with reproductive rights all along. And yes, when women have the ability to manage whether and when to have a child, then in fact the birth rates decline. And the families are healthier, the women are healthier. It's possible to get education, it's possible to develop. And those things have to, in fact, be in place and let women have options before a lot of the development or the education can actually take place in countries which have low resources and are stuck right now, unable to develop.
Well, you know, Martha, Greens are not going to want to hear that. We have plenty of problems to work with already, nuclear reactors and oil leaks and the climate problem. But on the other hand, we want to save the Amazon, even though part of the pressure on the Amazon and on forests around the world is just more and more people who need a place to farm and to live and to make a living. So what happens if we don't confront this, if Greenpeace and Sierra Club and Friends of Earth just stay out of the population issue? What happens?
I think what happens is that people will suffer more, and they don't recognize this. It's hard for people to think in terms of big numbers. I happen to be a math person. I was ever since I was a child, and I saw a graph on population when I was 11 years old, and it really stuck with me. But I didn't want to become a demographer later on. I wanted to instead to pay attention to how do we get people to get this? How do we get people to understand this when people generally don't understand big numbers? I don't know why they think that the world can keep going and going at levels of consumption and levels of population growth without having some huge difficulty, as you say, in the Amazon. And so my answer to them is no, population is not the only thing I think about. By all means, there are many, many factors. There are, for example, in our societies with great difficulty, the issues of corruption. There are issues of health. There are issues of environment. There are many things going on. It's just that there is also the population factor. It is only one factor. It just happens to be critical, attached to nearly everything else that you do.
Right. And you've written a new paper, something about freedom. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. We've written a paper called The Impact of Freedom on Fertility Decline. And what we're showing is that the theories behind fertility decline, which are widely meant to show that when people are healthier and educated and when people have more wealth, then birth rates will come down. We say that's not possible. It doesn't work that way. As a matter of fact, when you have high fertility in a country, the educational systems can't catch up with the need. And when you have high fertility, that is like four or five children or many, many more, then on average in a country, those poor countries can never develop. And the education can't happen until the birth rates come down. And then you need to do that. You have to be able to let women have the ability to manage whether and when to have a child.
And I think in response to what you said, it sounds to me like we've got the whole theory of population standing on its head. I mean, I've heard we need to have more education and more development, and then population will take care of itself. And you seem to be saying, no, 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 that's backwards.
Yes, as a matter of fact, John May, recently retired from the World Bank, who is now in the Population Reference Bureau, has pointed out in a meeting here at Berkeley that all countries that have five children or more have never, ever developed. And we have pointed out several years ago that we can't find any country that has gotten out of poverty while maintaining high fertility. And some economists have asked me, you know, wait a minute, where are your numbers on that? And I say, we've got our numbers. Our numbers are zero. We can't find any, except for, of course, a few oil-rich states. They're different from the rest, completely different. But on the whole, you just can't achieve it. When people talk about educating people or educating women and birth rates will decline, they're overlooking something. When you have a large average family size in a country, then what happens is that means you have many more children being born each year than the year before. And so in those countries, the governments cannot possibly keep up with the needs of the health systems in a country when you have many, many more children born each year than the year before. It's not possible. However, it is true that when people are educated, birth rates will come down. The problem is that most people will not get that education, and the group of people in those, or percentage of people in those countries who are not educated will grow and grow and grow. This is not development.
Now, Martha Campbell, is there something that I've missed that you would like to talk about?
I'd like to talk about, again, going back to the impact of freedom, that since it's not really been understood by a lot of people that you just let women have options and bring birth rates down, that you need to be able to understand that this means you need to let women make choices and women make decisions. You need to let girls go to school and have more schooling, and rather than having a baby at the age of 12, 13, 14. is as in parts of Africa, in fact, as in Afghanistan, for example. The Department of Defense already has picked up on the understanding that population growth and rapid population growth can lead to a lot of lack of security in terms of just violence around the world. A number of the people who were very, very active in women's advocacy groups, the problem was moving the family planning money out of foreign aid and into other things, in fact, didn't help at all. It just made the women poorer and poorer. And it helped in some small parts of the world, but it never worked on a large scale. Scale is very, very important here. And helping women on a large scale requires broadcasting with correct information, making sure there are enough contraceptives for people who want it, letting women have options, changing culture. That's another piece. I would like to talk about culture for a moment. Whenever I join a new class and get involved in a new class at Berkeley, I ask the students, how many of you have learned in sociology or anthropology that you mustn't interfere with culture? And about a third of the class raises their hand, always. And I say, well, let's rethink this. Let's think about it now, because there are different sides to culture. Culture means beautiful music. It means what people wear, what people eat, certain kinds of traditions that can be very nice. That's benign. Then there's this other piece of culture, which is very often there, called let's keep control of women. I say, I think that it is fair to say, let's upset culture. Nafi Sadiq, the Pakistani physician who ran the United Nations Population Fund from 1987 to year 2000, is still very active asking governments, wait a minute, what about these values you don't want us to interfere with and you call it culture? Have women written these values or did you men write these values? And is this about keeping control of women and don't you think you should rethink this? She's a real champion on this, and I think it's extremely important to recognize that we can talk about culture and say, it's got a problem. When there are problems in a culture, we don't have to say. We have to leave it alone. We can criticize it. This goes along with the religion also. And that when religious forces actually harm women and harm families and harm the future of this planet, I think we ought to think very, very seriously about what's good about religion and what's really, really bad. So these are things on my mind, and I hope this is useful for you.
It's very useful for me, and I'm glad that you're willing to break the silence. You've been listening to Martha Campbell. She's the founder and president of the nonprofit group Venture Strategies for Health and Development. She's based in Berkeley. She lectures and writes about the coming storm surge, I would call it, of new human beings on Earth and what we could do about it. Check out her essay in the book Life on the Brink, Environmentalists Confront Overpopulation, from the University of Georgia Press. And find more links to Martha's work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Martha Campbell, thank you so much for breaking the comfortable silence.
Alex, may I add of where people can get these two papers? And it's in the Bixby Center for Population Health and Sustainability at the University of California at Berkeley. And the way they can get these two papers, and that is the impact of freedom on fertility decline, and also do economists have frequent sex, they can find this under publications in Bixby, that's Bixby, .berkeley.edu.
Thank you so much. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. Find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. Check out the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info for all the links. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.